So this morning I would like to talk to you about a very short poem from Rumi, Jalaluddin Rumi, the Persian poet from the 13th century, who I know a lot of you are familiar with. I've been told he's the best-selling poet in America right now. So it took him 800 years to do it, but I think that's pretty good, right? And I chose this. This morning. I know Tim talked about a Rumi poem 2 weeks ago, and I think he talked about one the week before that. We're in kind of a Rumi bender here, I guess. But I've been working on this for a while, and I chose it because I was leading a retreat recently, probably a month and a half, maybe 2 months ago, at the Episcopal House of Prayer down here in Loring Park. And at one point in the retreat, all of the retreatants were assigned a koan. They were talking about a koan. Our topic that week was Buddhist scripture, which I had something to do with. So they were all talking about a koan, and I had to kind of vanish for about 15, 20 minutes and give them time to kind of mull this over. So I was hanging out in the director's office there, and he had this poem in a frame on his wall. So I read it and was like, oh, that's nice. And I've been in that office a million times, and that's really a nice piece. But because I had nothing to do for 15 or 20 minutes, I just sort of read it. And then it started to kind of break open a little bit for me. You know how that happens when you're familiar with it, you think you get it. But then if you sit inside of it for a while, it starts kind of opening up for you. And by the end of this 20-minute break, I decided that would be a good Zen talk. That's a list of instructions. And as Buddhists, I think we're predisposed to lists. I don't know. Buddhism's just lousy with lists. So I decided that would make a good list. And it does. I think it actually forms a really nice list of practice instructions for us as Zen students. So it's on the front of your bulletin for those of you who have it. And for those of you who don't, just sort of look on with somebody, or you can just sort of store this in your head. It's quite short. It reads, "Seek the wisdom that will untie your knot. Seek the path that demands your whole being. Leave that which is not, but appears to be. Seek that which is, but is not apparent." That's pretty good. So I think I'll just talk about it, line by line, and we'll just sort of see together what comes up. But the thing I liked immediately about it was it felt really direct to me. It's very brief, very direct. And although I guess we could say it's a poem, he's not spending any time on like fancy images or metaphor. There's no like moon or spoon or June or anything like that. There's no rippling waters or white herons or anything. It's just, he's very, very direct here. And I get the impression almost, it's kind of just an emotional feeling, that he's kind of giving it to you straight, almost like he wrote this fast, like almost with a sense of urgency around it, almost like, all right, here it is, bang. I kind of like that about it. And I also get the impression that he's addressing everybody. This feels to me like universal instruction. This doesn't feel to me like the sort of secret instruction that you get behind the screen from the teacher. It's some sort of, you know, just for the exclusive. This sort of just is like, blah, here, human race, take this. That's my impression anyway. So I appreciate that it's not a rarefied exclusive type of teaching. And because it feels to me so direct, it doesn't feel like it's being whispered. It feels like it's being shouted from the rooftops. This feels to me kind of like a call to arms. And the other thing I liked about it right away is it reminded me very much of the Buddha's, the historical Buddha's original teaching, which perhaps wasn't shouted, but was definitely intended for everyone. Buddha's teaching is intended for everyone. It is not exclusive. So our first word is seek. We start the poem with the word seek, which seems really appropriate, I'm sure, for most of us. There's a word in Buddhism, a Sanskrit word that we use, bodhicitta, which is often translated as way-seeking mind. Way-seeking mind, it's the part of us that wants to wake up. The part of us that seeks some sort of spiritual practice, the part of us who wants something kind of deeper. So from a Buddhist point of view, you've all got it just to be here. You must have at least some of it, right? Suzuki Roshi said, "It is wisdom which is seeking wisdom." That's kind of bodhicitta. The part of you that wants to wake up is the part of you that's awake. Right? The fact that you even recognize that there's a possibility of something deeper means there's something awake in you that's already resonating with that. Right? That's pretty cool. So this idea of seeking, this idea of seeking is universal to all the spiritual paths, of course, this idea that we need to go someplace or to look for something. And I appreciate the fact that it's an active verb. You have to do it. So he's definitely kind of encouraging action here. Don't just stay home and wait for it to kind of maybe fall down upon you. You have to actually do something. So that's bad news or good news, depending on how you look at it, I guess. But there's definitely the idea that you have to do something, that it is our responsibility, which is also very much in keeping with the original teachings of the Buddha. One of the things that really drew me to Buddhism when I first started reading about it, many years ago, was that it was my responsibility to do it. I really liked that I wasn't being carried by somebody else or delivered by somebody else, that this was my job. If I'm struggling, it's like, oh, well, the good news is you can do something about that. The bad news is you have to do something about that. You know, it's definitely a double-edged sword. But I appreciated it because it just felt honest, sort of, to me. I just felt like, yeah, okay, at least you're not lying to me. It just felt really deeply true to me. So I appreciate that it's our responsibility. And I appreciate that Rumi's just saying, this is you. This is you. You're the one who gets to do it. So we start with seeking. Well, why? Why are we seeking? And that's something I think we all actually intuitively understand. Yeah, even if we don't have words around that, I think we all kind of get it. And from a Buddhist point of view, again, it starts with that idea of the knot. Seek the wisdom that will untie your knot. The supposition here is that you have a knot. You have a knot. You've got something that needs untying, or else you wouldn't need to seek, right? If you had no difficulties, of course you wouldn't be seeking freedom. So this is the first noble truth. In Buddhist terms, the universality of struggle, the universality of dis-ease or suffering. It's part of the human condition. It's part of what we get. So seek the wisdom that will untie your knot. He's taking it for granted you've got a knot and that you're ready to do something about it. And, you know, the wisdom part, seek the wisdom. That's his promise to us of the possibility of freedom. Because of the way he's phrasing this, he's not saying some people can get free. He's saying everybody can get free. If you seek this, you will find it. It reminds me a little bit of knock and the door shall be opened unto you. That kind of universal, if you look, it'll happen. I really appreciated the warmth of that promise. When I'm thinking back to when I was a kid sitting in church, that one line, I was like, ooh, I like that. So that's the promise of freedom, this wisdom. Which is why, of course, he says, seek the wisdom that will untie your knot, as opposed to, you know, seek the expensive sports car that will untie your knot, or speak the totally hot partner that will untie your knot, or seek job security and a nice retirement, you know. That would have totally ruined the poem. But you know, the wisdom here, and this is true for Buddhism too. The wisdom isn't a fancy wisdom, you know. It's not clever. It's not a pithy saying. It doesn't fit on a fortune cookie note. It isn't certainly esoteric or difficult to wrap your brain around. Wisdom has to be, for wisdom to liberate us, for something that we call wisdom to free us from suffering, it has to be an experience. It has to be felt experience of freedom. Or else it's just an idea, right? It's just a concept. We have to actually taste it. And that's really what Buddhist practice is about, especially Zen practice, is about tasting for ourselves the boundlessness of our lives. You know, how big they really are. How free we really are. We have to actually experience that. If we just have an idea in your head and the teacher tells you, your life is boundless and you were born free and you will always be free. That's nice. But it doesn't help much unless you have experienced some of that. I think we get that too. I think that makes sense. So cleverness doesn't free us, unfortunately. Words don't free us, unfortunately. Only that experience. I learned this weekend, somebody told me, a friend of mine told me that, you know that saying, seeing is believing. She's an art professor, a retired art professor at St. Olaf, and she told me, so this is just hearsay, but I like it, so I'm clinging to it as truth. What she said is, that's just the first half of the saying, and it's funny to me that that's really caught on. You hear that all the time, well, seeing is believing, but the second half of the phrase you never hear. And she said the whole phrase is, seeing is believing, but feeling is the truth. And I went, oh, that changes everything. That's really cool. And she went, I know. Isn't that weird? So I've been saying that to myself. Seeing is believing, but feeling is the truth. And I went, oh, so there's the emphasis on experience. Because she's at art, you know, like sculpture, and she's very tactile. She said, it's funny that we oftentimes think as humans that our primary sense is sight. And it's not. Our primary sense, of course, is touch. We're gathering information via touch way, way, way earlier in our life than we're actually organizing, you know, experience and data via our eyes. So she said, this is the primary one, the touching. Which makes sense, like when you're a kid, you know how you want to put everything in your mouth. And you want to touch, touch, touch. You know, just seeing isn't enough. Like, oh, that's cool, Mom. No, you want to grab her, right? You want to touch her. So there's something very intimate about that. And that's the kind of experience that we emphasize in Zen practice. And I think that that's the type of wisdom, I think, that frees us. So this verse was translated from, I don't know, Persian or Farsi. Geez, I should know that. But it was translated by Coleman Barks, and I know that's a name a lot of you know, too. He's the most popular translator of Rumi's poetry. And in the introduction to one of his books, he tells a really cool and very short story about freedom that's from the Sufis, this old Sufi story. And it goes, a man is visited in prison by a friend who he hopes will help him escape by bringing him a file or some tool for physically escaping, but all his friend brings is a prayer rug. He begins to do his 5 times a day prayer, and after a period, he realizes that the place where his forehead touches the rug, the point called the Qibla, is a diagram of the working of the tumblers of the lock on his cell door. And he escapes. That is such a cool story. I love it. I just think it's a really cool story. And our wisdom that Rumi's talking about has to give us some measure of freedom from suffering, or else it's useless, right? We have to get out of ourselves. That's the point. So the other element of this line, seek the wisdom that will untie your knot, is the metaphor he uses, a knot. I really like that, because strictly speaking, this is Zen now, but strictly speaking, a knot is just an idea. There's no such thing as a knot. It's just rope, right? It's rope that's been looped, but it's just rope. It doesn't actually exist in any independent, real way. It's just the rope. So the rope of our life, we experience as twisted. We experience as suffering. We experience as dis-ease and difficulty. And it feels to us like a problem. The rope feels real. The rope is real. What causes us a lot of difficulty, though, is that we start to believe in the knot. You know, we put a lot of emphasis on that knot. The difficult person, or the pain in the knee, or the car payment, or whatever that thing is, we start to really believe in that knot. It's not to say it shouldn't be addressed. of course it has its own life in a certain way, but it's important to remember that our life is just circling back through itself in a way that feels like a problem, but it's really just our life, right? There's nothing else going on. This is just the shape of our life right now. We call it not, but it's nothing separate from our life, right? It's nothing extra. It's nothing added. It's just our life, free-flowing. Free-flowing all the time. So that works for me. That metaphor of the not really works for me. And the awareness of this doesn't always change our experience of difficulty. But it is helpful to remember that our difficulties aren't extra added onto our lives, that they are our lives. There's a subtle difference there, right? It's like that billboard that says, you aren't stuck in traffic, you are traffic. That's brutal, right? That one hit me like a ton of bricks. I was like, oh my God, you're right. I'm traffic. I hate traffic. So, the knot. The knot in your life is your life. The trouble in your life is your life. It isn't extra. And hopefully that idea can help just soften our relationship with it a little, right? Maybe we can just open up just a little bit to that. Does a rope mind having a knot in it? I wonder. I just wonder if a rope minds having a knot in it, or if having a knot is part of the purpose of a rope, its function. I don't know. But life sure seems to knot up, right? Seems like that's actually what it does. It's not doing it wrong when it does that. That's actually what it does. So in other words, already you lack nothing. You lack nothing. So, the second line. Seek the path that demands your whole being. Well, this is an easy one to talk about from a Zen point of view, because we spend a lot of time talking about wholehearted effort in Zen, whole being effort. You know, we are completely exposed in Zen practice. We are completely exposed. There's a great beauty and a great courage to that, but we really are completely exposed. And all of you who have spent more than about 15 minutes sitting in Zazen know exactly what I mean. You might not like that restlessness is coming up again, or anger is coming up again, or that bad memory is coming up again, or planning for that thing you know you can't plan for is coming up again, or your greed, or your lust, or your ignorance, or your grasping, or your whatever, but there it is again. There it is again. We're just completely exposed. Because we sit down with no props, no toys, it's just, here we go again. I'm not really selling it here, am I? You know what I mean, though, right? That's part of the kind of the honesty of Zen practice. That's part of the beauty of Zen practice. Getting to see that. Getting to see it. Being exposed. There it is again. I think that's part of the reason I trust it. You know, even if I don't always prefer it, I think it's part of the reason I trust it. Because it just doesn't have any lies to offer me. It really is just this. Here we go again. So I really appreciate that about it. So seek the path that demands your whole being. And this is where Rumi starts making a little more insistent demands, right? You can almost feel this. Demands your whole being, almost like he's challenging you. Look at yourself, look at the part you're leaving out. Is there something you're holding back? You know, am I a really, just really good, devoted Buddhist spiritual practitioner when I'm at Zen Center? And then on the way home, I'm a wide-awake nightmare? Am I rude to my cat? Am I rude to my wife? Did I hang up on the telemarketer? Did I use, you know, whatever, bad language, bad action? There's something about being divided inside that I think gives us suffering. We really want to be undivided. We really are undivided. But you know what I mean? To actually taste the experience of being undivided. Your whole being. Tim likes to quote the line, you can't serve two masters at once. Jesus said, you can't serve two masters at once. You can't serve God and man. Oh yeah, that makes sense. Zen practice, you know. I'm going to do this, but I'm also going to do this. That kind of trying to have it all. We're kind of almost scripted to do that in this country. We have kind of a hungry go society, but Zen practice demands of us, or it politely requests of us, wholehearted practice. Rumi might demand it, but Zen practice is a little more gentle. So I like to ask myself what I leave out. What are the areas in my life in which I let myself off the hook, maybe when I shouldn't, when I indulge myself, maybe when I shouldn't. And I think the implication here is that in order for something to be deeply transformative, to actually change who you are, change your life, it has to be comprehensive. So that's why, like, the Eightfold Path covers all those things, right? Your view, the way you are in the world with behavior, the way you work with your mind on the cushion. This is a comprehensive that demands you work with all these different areas of your life in order to really change who you are. Makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense to me, actually. So with the Eightfold Path, we don't get to choose our favorites and ignore the rest. I have several. I have three that I'd like to ignore, but I don't get to. All the time, I don't get to. And I was also told very early here, actually when I first started coming here, that Zazen doesn't end when you stand up from the cushion, right? That it's all day. It's all the time. It's your whole life. You know, it's your whole life. Keep bringing yourself back. So it is. It is a path of transformation, and it is a path that is devised, intended, and carried out as a comprehensive. It is a whole life practice. I'm fond of this quote. Ajahn Chah, he was a Thai forest Buddhist teacher. He was one of Jack Kornfield's early teachers, for those of you who know Jack Kornfield. He said, if you let go a little, you will be a little happy. If you let go more, you will be more happy. And if you let go all the way, you will be free. So there is your whole being. There's wholehearted practice. If you let go all the way, that's pretty challenging, actually. So our third line today is, leave that which is not, but appears to be. Leave that which is not, but appears to be. So for me, this was about the spirit of relinquishment that we get in spiritual practice. We talk a lot about that in Zen. We talk a lot about home leaving, the idea of home leaving. We talk a lot about the idea of being in the world but not of the world. All those are different ways of talking about recognizing that which is just the shine on the surface and being willing to open our hands and let it go. The term home leaving, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is something that's been talked about in Buddhism since the very beginning. And in early Buddhism, this was a reality. When you were ordained as a Buddhist, you would physically, literally leave home. You know, you shave your head, you get the robe, you get the bowl, that's it, you're done, off you go. So that was the expectation. In that culture at that time, that was what they felt was the most skillful. Like, if you really want to free yourself, this is what you need to do. So it's had ways of manifesting itself in Buddhism that have been literal, and it's also had ways of manifesting itself that are more of a metaphor, I think, for a state of heart. We still call the ordination ceremony here the home leaving ceremony. And it isn't expected that you are literally leaving your home in the middle of Minnesota in the middle of winter, but that in your heart you've left home. And home, of course, is a metaphor for what? Just everything we surround ourselves with that insulates us. That insulates us from the actual experience of life. There's nothing wrong with comfort. This doesn't have that type of feel to it. But there is something wrong with that which keeps us from the truth. there's something wrong with that which allows us to stay asleep. Does that make sense? So home leaving is about being willing to see what we usually don't. Being willing to see our blind spots. Being willing to take off those blinders when we're asked to do that. It's about releasing the lies that we normally accept. And they're very subtle ones, and we all have them. You know, I will not die is my favorite. It's my operating system most of the time. I mean, you know, you can feel, I can feel in my body when that shifts. When I, on some level, accept, oh, right, this whole thing's going away. I can actually feel it. Like, oh, yeah. And then something shifts in me. And then I go back to being asleep again about it. That's okay. That's part of practice. But it is, this idea of home leaving is a willingness to be with what's real, to the best of our ability, to the best of our capacity at that time. It's a gentleness. But it's being willing to at least see it. Oh, yes, Martin very much likes to kid himself into thinking that the following items are true. And then be aware of them. Just be aware of them. That's all we have to do is just see them. Leaving that which is not, but appears to be, I guess what I would say is the primary metaphor for that in Buddhism is the life of the Buddha. The story that we all agree upon, the myth of his life is that he is raised as a prince and has pretty much everything, and he leaves all of it. That he literally sees through, oh, none of this that I have, fame, wealth, status, will prevent me from growing old, getting sick, and dying. None of these things actually insulate me from the depth of human suffering, so I will abandon them. That's where we get our primary metaphor, our primary example. We could kind of say he's the archetypal home leaver, I suppose. But what we're most interested in Zen practice, at least in the 21st century in Minnesota, is not literal poverty, but spiritual poverty. There's another wonderful early Sufi saying that says, asceticism is not that you should not own anything, but that nothing should own you. I think 21st century Americans really get this. How many of our possessions own us? It's a lot, right? I mean, wow. There's a lot of stuff that we feel beholden to. So he's talking about just really see that relationship. Really see that. Be willing to see that. Be willing to let it go if need be. If this is causing suffering, then we have to let this go. So our decision in Buddhists, when we take the precepts, we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, teacher, teaching, and community as a way of letting go of that insulation. So it's funny that we use the word refuge, because in a sense it's almost the opposite. In a weird way, it's actually a decision to remain exposed to the truth, right? And our shelter, our refuge, is a path that leads us from suffering to non-suffering. And we do that with the teacher, the teaching, and the community. But it's not about, you know, hiding underneath or being numbed or in any way protected. We are constantly opening our eyes, constantly being exposed. So Katagiri used to say, it's a chosen position of vulnerability. That makes it sound very brave, I think. It does. So the other part of this, leaving that which is not but appears to be, the part I actually find very challenging in my life, is there's a social implication to this for me, that a lot of my insulating habits are about dividing self from other in the form of judgment. That's just part of my own personal karma. I just got that big time. So I have to be really, really aware of how I insulate myself from experience through my judgments about myself and about other people. So one of the ways this pops up in my life is, oh, that guy's a jerk. Those people aren't like us, you know? I don't get to say that anymore. I really don't. I mean, I do. I say it. But I can't. When I catch myself, like, no. You can't actually say that anymore. Number one, it's not true. I can't actually say that guy's a jerk. There's no such thing as jerk, for one thing. And number two, I don't know anything about that guy. So whatever it was he just did, cut me off on the freeway or whatever that little thing is, it's just part of me making up a story that keeps him separate. And that's what? A defense for my feelings. I am, what, scared, maybe? Ashamed, frustrated, something. I don't like that feeling at all, actually. So in about an eighth of a second, I tell myself a story about how, oh, I get what's going on. He's bad. And isn't that nice? Because by default, that means, I'm good. Yes, I am. I'm obeying the speed limit, and I'm so good, and he cut in front of me. Oh, kids these days, I mean, you know. I'm telling myself a story. So part of what this is for me is having to expose myself to that feeling. You know, so to stick with the cut off in the freeway metaphor, for example, if I'm cut off, the actual primary experience is fear. Like, I'm scared, right? The animal part of my brain has hijacked everything else, and I'm scared because I'm going 60 miles an hour, and all of a sudden there's somebody in front of me, and very realistically, I could be hurt or die. But after he's in my lane and that 3 seconds passes or whatever, I'm right back to being totally fine, sitting in a fabulously comfortable chair with complete climate control. I'm 100% safe, and everything is fine. But I do not let go of that feeling because fear, which is very, very uncomfortable, very, very primary, has turned into a story about how that guy's a jerk. And if he's got bumper stickers that help kind of help my view, very useful. I'm just saying, if you're looking for information to help tell a story, that helps. So I, you know, it's 5 minutes later. It is 5 minutes later, and I'm still stuck there, right? To some degree, I might not be actually thinking anymore about that specific guy, but those types of people. All because I had that experience that was really scary, and it's hard to be with fear. Oh, I'm scared. I don't want to die. And that, although it's turned into anger now, the anger's just covering it, just glossing it over, just distracting me from that primary feeling. So as soon as I recognize I'm telling myself a story to insulate myself from experience, and the story I'm telling causes suffering, I am miserable, and if I could actually interact with that guy, I'd probably make him miserable too. Jerk! Not helpful. From a Buddhist point of view, once I see that, it is 100% my responsibility. I'm obligated to change that. I'm obligated to let go of the storyline. I'm obligated to do something skillful about that to the best of my ability. I've got to let that idea go. So when I'm in a situation like that, it's just usually second after second going, let it go, let it go, let it go, because you know how fast it comes back, right? And after a few minutes, it stops coming back quite so insistently, and after a while, you know, another song comes on the radio and it's long gone. But that's the practice. Let it go, let it go, and that's my obligation. So there is a social element to this, I think. When I recognize that my speech, my action, my livelihood, even my worldview, if they cause me or others suffering, I am absolutely obligated to change those things, to work with them. In a sense, I'm never off the hook. Does that kind of make sense in a way? So it's actually a really tall order. To leave that which appears to be but is not, that's a tough one. Because that guy really does appear to be a jerk. And I know he's not. I've got to leave it. I've got to leave it. Second after second, I have to abandon it. So this is, in a sense, another way of being exposed. Because once we see something, we can't unsee it. Isn't that weird? You guys all know what that is, right? Like, once you see that thing about yourself, oh, now I see it. So, like, once you know what motivates you, you know what motivates you. And how often that is greed, hate, or ignorance, you know, aversion, desire. Tough to see. Tough to see. But the good part is we also see with equal clarity when our motivation behind our actions and speech and livelihood, when our motivation is based on connection, love, compassion, when it just comes out, and your desire 100% is really just to connect, to help. That's just beautiful to see that clearly, to not insulate yourself from that either. Because they both happen. And this part that we're talking about, this the practice part of letting it go and being willing to see it, this is starting to sound a lot like discipline. Isn't it? That's the practice part, the discipline part. When you become a serious spiritual student, you have to agree to do that discipline. And that's a word we do not like. We do not like the word discipline. Most of us don't. I think because we equate it with punishment. You know, when you're a kid and your parents talk about discipline, you're like, "That, no, that's just mean. I don't get to watch my TV show. Or I have to stay in my room for 20 minutes until I'm ready to come out and apologize to my sister." I mean, hypothetically. Whatever your thing was. Sorry, Molly. But discipline we have a hard time with. And, you know, I'm very fortunate. I've got some wonderful teachers in my life, and I was struggling with discipline at one point in my life, and she was really emphasizing, "Oh, discipline." I was like, "Like all of a sudden you're my mom when you use that word." She said, "Oh, no, discipline. It's the same word as disciple. It's just that's the same root. What do you want to be a disciple of?" Oh, that's nice. I like that. Yes, what do I want to be a disciple of? Like, what's really important to me? So maybe for us, leaving that which is not, maybe that's just about seeing our acquisitiveness, that hungry feeling that we try to satisfy. Maybe it's about just seeing that. Or maybe it's about staying with that feeling of fear on the freeway for just another couple seconds. Just stay with it. To just be willing to sit inside it and let it transform on its own. That could be our discipline. It could be something else for you. But I like the idea of it being part of being a disciple of something. So my sister, who I just apologized to a few minutes ago, I do that frequently because I was really a wretched older brother when I was young. She says, "Discipline is remembering what you love." That's about perfect. Discipline is remembering what you love. So I really don't want to go for a run today. Running is hard. Running is cold. Running is sweaty. I don't want to do it. Oh, but there is something about that I love. I love feeling awake, and I love my body feeling loose and warm, and I love being the weight that I am, and I love all the things that come with that. So my decision in this moment to go for the run and not sit on the couch with a bowl of popcorn is not discipline. I'm not being punished in the old way, right? This is discipline reminding myself, this is what I love. This is actually who I most truly am. I'm a disciple of that. That's what I want. It's just remembering that. So I was like, geez, that's brilliant. It's brilliant. I wrote that one down. I look at it frequently because I think it's really helpful. So we need discipline, of course, to let go of the things that don't help and to change our behaviors. But I like to think that it's a way of reminding ourselves who we really are. And we help each other in community, too. There's a strong community component to these things. I'm thinking, I guess, as I'm saying this, about our biannual practice periods that we have here at Zen Center. Twice a year we have an 8-week practice period where people come every week. We meet once a week for a couple hours in the evening. And we have a theme, or we read a text or something like this together. And during the week, we usually commit to more sitting than we normally do. We commit to a retreat day, spending some time here at Zen Center, that kind of thing. And so it's a way of communally reminding ourselves who we really want to be. It's a wonderful way, actually, of practice. So for those of you who have never done practice period here, I would encourage you to try it. Even if you're new to this whole thing, you can kind of set your bar where you want it. It's really a wonderful way of connecting to your practice and to the community and reminding yourself over essentially the course of 2 months, there's something really important in my life I don't want to forget. I'm going to do this. I really want to remember every single day. For at least a little while, this is who I want to be. This is important. So if you're interested in that, there's sign-up sheets on the porch and on the website and stuff, or ask me about it later. It's a wonderful practice. So the other thing we have to be aware of are our assumptions about what appears to be, and especially when our ego is involved and our preferences are involved, because we tend to filter reality through our preferences, and we don't see what's really there. We make assumptions about what's really there, but we don't actually see it. So there's a great story here about two boats that meet head-on in a shipping channel at night. As boats are wont to do in the dark, boat number one flashed boat number two, "We are on a collision course. Turn your boat 10 degrees north." Boat two signaled back, "Yes, we are on a collision course. turn your boat 10 degrees south. Boat 1 signaled again, I am an admiral in Her Majesty's Navy. I am telling you to turn your boat 10 degrees north. Boat 2 flashed back immediately, and I am just a seaman, second class, and I am telling you to turn your boat 10 degrees south. By this time, the admiral is furious. He flashes back, I repeat, I am an admiral in Her Majesty's Navy, and I am commanding you to turn your boat 10 degrees north. I am in a battleship. The second boat returned with a signal that said, and I am commanding you to turn your boat 10 degrees south. I am in a lighthouse. So I won't tell you who wins, but so that's a wonderful such a crazy story. The lighthouse is real, but it was not apparent to the ship's captain because of ego, right? Because of ego. That's just like me telling myself a story about the jerk who cuts me off because of his car and his bumper stickers. And if I think of how many lighthouses in my life I have tried to bully into turning. So the good news in all this is there's the promise of transformation, the possibility of transformation. Because if we couldn't actually change, of course, none of this would be useful to us. The implication in all this stuff, in the Buddha's early teaching, in Rumi's lovely little verse here, is that you can change. You can change. The stuff that causes suffering for you and others is impermanent. It can be changed. You get to be free, you know. There's a lovely promise there. So let's do that together. Let's do that leaving together. Let's do that reminding each other together. And our last line is seek that which is but is not apparent. Seek that which is but is not apparent. Well, truth is invisible. It's not really apparent in a real sense, but it's also right here. In Zen practice, you know, truth is not seen as other or as transcendent, meaning apart from this. It's here. So when we learn about things like interconnectedness, you know, or impermanence, or even the truth of suffering, they're usually invisible to us. Those things are usually invisible to us, but that doesn't prevent them from being true. So although they're not apparent, making a choice to continually touch them is how we stay awake. So it's almost like when you're when you're a kid in science class in elementary school and they tell you that our Earth turns at over 1,000 miles an hour. Turning over 1,000 miles an hour, and then you're told that our Earth goes 67,000 miles an hour around the sun. And you can hardly believe it, because everything's sitting still. Right? So, it's true. Both those things are true. 67,000 miles an hour we're going around the sun, 1,000 miles an hour we're rotating. But that doesn't feel true, because everything seems so still. So that's true, just like impermanence is true, just like our interconnectedness is true. These are indisputable, actually. These are aspects of reality that are true whether we want to see them or not. So, and if I'm feeling a little contrary, which actually occurs a lot in my life, I like to be contrary. I can take a little bit of an issue here with my friend Rumi, just because from a Zen point of view, which is no point of view at all, there's really no such thing as a Zen point of view, but let's pretend that there is. From a Zen point of view, that which truly is nothing but apparent, right? I mean, it's only here. So when he says, seek that which is but is not apparent, you could say, show me this truth that isn't apparent. Of course it's apparent. The truth of our lives is never obscured for even a moment. It's always right here, wide awake and alive. It's never hidden, ever. Like, ever. How could it be? Here it is. Because it's not other. The kingdom of heaven is spread out upon the earth, but men do not see it. So it's right here, from a Zen point of view. Whether it's apparent to us or not, it is right here. And it's hard for us to see because we are it. Right? So to wrap up today, the single best thing about this little poem to me, and I'll return to this kind of what I opened with, but I really appreciate the confidence with which this verse is said. His voice is so clear. 800 years ago he wrote it, but it's so clear right now. It's really alive on the page to me. It's so directive. I can almost feel him imploring us to practice. He's almost ordering us, like, hey, you, wake up. Wake up. The freedom train is leaving. Get on, you know. This is it. Wake up. And it seems to be such a confident voice. It seems... I'll even amend that. I won't even say seems. I know enough about Rumi to know that this confidence that he had when he gave us instruction like this came from an experience that he lived in. This wasn't an idea he had. This was where this guy lived. He was wide awake. And so this poem is kind of like what Tim calls a letter from home. A letter from home, reminding us, right? A letter from home. This isn't a made-up story. This is a letter. And so he's assuring us that the seeking is worthwhile. This seeking is 100% worthwhile. It will take you where you need to go. That promise is kind of just written into everything he's saying. And so in this way, Rumi is, he's like all of our best teachers. You know, when you have that teacher in your life, they guide you and they support you, and you can tell that they're so sure. You know, they're so confident of your ability to do this. They're just 100% sure. It, like, never occurs to them to doubt that you can do this. Of course you can do this. They're so confident. They're always encouraging us, supporting us, begging us not to quit and not to lose heart. You know, you can do this because I did it. You will find it because I found it. And I think ultimately these teachers of ours know this because they see how free we already are. It's not even that you've got the fortitude to hang in there and you will someday be free. It's like, I can see it right now. Wide awake, 100% free. I think it's where that confidence comes from. Their experience of that freedom, seeing it in us. How free we have always been. So Rumi is our teacher, and we are fortunate. We are fortunate to have him, like we are fortunate to have all of our teachers, all of our poets and sages and saints and cats and dogs and children and parents and our Suzukis and our Tims. We're very, very fortunate. So let's listen to them together. Let's listen to them. Thank you very much. What do you think? Based on the time, maybe we can entertain a question or two. I went a little long. Anybody have any comments, questions, feedback, complaints? Rumi? He was a Sufi mystic. Persian, you know, Sufism is the kind of the mystical branch of Islam. So he lived in the 1200s. He actually was a contemporary of Dogen and Meister Eckhart, believe it or not. The same time in three different places in the world, three of the great mystics were alive. And he's one of the people who's credited with founding the Sufi order. Do you guys know about the whirling dervishes, the form of meditation where they whirl and whirl? That's him. He invented that. And so he's a poet. Incredibly prolific writer, thousands and thousands and thousands of pages. But yeah, a mystic, for lack of a better word, I would say he was a realized man. And his writing, although it has a Islamic flavor, very devotional, for me, it just burns on the page. It's absolutely amazing. When I discovered him, I was just like, I have never read words that could do this before. It just lit a fire in me. I just thought it was fabulous. Highly recommended. Anybody else have anything? Yes? My sister's words of wisdom. Discipline is remembering what you love. Discipline is remembering what you love. Yeah, thank her. It's like really good. I know, and I shouldn't. I shouldn't sound surprised. She has been nothing but a blessing to me, and she's actually the one who's responsible for me sitting here. She's the one who got me into this crazy thing in the first place. Yes, she's a profound. I'm very lucky. I'm very lucky. As much of a jerk as I was as a little kid, I don't know what I did. It's karma or something. But yes. Discipline is remembering what you love. It's awfully nice. Thank you, Molly. All right, I think...
I'll offer a comment.
Oh, sure.
You took these lines separately. By the way, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I take the last two as a pair, because if I'm distracted or in the illusion or separated myself from direct experience, mm-hmm. so that I'm chasing these phantoms,
yeah.
then I'm not doing the last one.
Yeah.
So I think what you said about yeah. that is absolutely true. It's right here. But if I'm in the addiction or whatever, I can't see it.
Yeah, you're right. Those last two lines were essentially a pair, right? Flip
yeah.
sides of the same
yeah.
coin. Leave that which is, but, you know, and then, yeah. And I think they have to be taken as such. It's kind of one big pill. So I like the way you said that. Thank you all very, very much.